Hello, everybody out there. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. My name is Carl Ozhahovsky, and I will be your host for this lovely hour of animal-related talk. On today's program, we have a very exciting guest. I am extremely, extremely impressed with the book that she has just written. We'll be speaking with Leslie Irvine. She's written a book called Filling the Ark, Animal Welfare in Disasters. The book looks at how our treatment of animals makes them more or less vulnerable in times of crisis, things like floods, hurricanes, that sort of thing, but also in terms of human-made disasters, such as oil spills. So we'll be talking with her about her book at about the quarter past the hour mark. But first, we are going to get to some news. And maybe before we get to some news, I'll do a little bit of housekeeping. We always get lots of emails and correspondence and people suggesting shows. And of course, we want to keep that coming. So if you want to get in touch with us, please do. Our email address is animalvoices@gmail.com. Our website address, where you can download this program soon, and over 270, maybe 80 or so at this point, past programs online. You can check out www.animalvoices.ca. We're also on the Facebook. If you want to get in touch with us through there, key in Animal Voices and look for the Animal Voices group there. You can find us and you can keep up to speed on the things that we're up to these days. And you can also get news on any special events we're having or advance notice about shows and that sort of thing as well. So I'd like to get to a few news articles that I found this week, and actually this was an interesting week for animal news. A lot of stories that I haven't really seen before, so I'd like to get to that now. And the first story is coming to us from BroadcastNewsroom.com. The headline, an interesting one, Media Coalition Members Against Ban on Media Depictions of Animal Cruelty. It believes that animal cruelty is abhorrent, but argues the government is breaking dangerous new ground in criminalizing the depictions. Independent filmmakers fear that films like Apocalypse Now, in which a live buffalo is hacked to death, documentaries about cruelty to animals, or even TV news footage of Alaska Governor Sarah Palin wolf hunting in Alaska, could earn their creators and distributors prison sentences if a 1999 law is restored by the Supreme Court. A number of members of the Media Coalition have asked the High Court to uphold a lower court's decision to strike down a law banning depictions of animal cruelty, saying the law is overbroad and, as the Obama administration is interpreting it, could give the federal government, quote, substantial power to decide whether certain words and images are worthy of First Amendment protection. Among those signing on to the friend of the court brief was the Independent Film and Television Alliance, which represents distributors of films, including documentaries. Not signing on, though, were the Motion Picture Association of America, according to its website, though it is also a member of the coalition. Theater Owners Group and Documentary Lobby were also among the signatories. While the coalition makes it clear that it believes animal cruelty is abhorrent, it argues that the government is breaking dangerous new ground in criminalizing the depictions. Quote, if the court were to agree that speech about violence can be banned in order to discourage violence, in this case cruelty to animals, it would imperil not just a wide range of speech that engages with the violent world in which we live, but also speech concerning other conduct that may be viewed as undesirable and thus potentially subject to restriction, the brief said. The case deals with a Virginia man sentenced to over 3 years in prison in 2004 by a Pennsylvania federal court for selling videos showing pit bulls fighting and being trained to hunt wild boar. The conviction was for violating a 1999 law that makes it a crime to sell, possess, or distribute any depictions of animal cruelty. And the second news story coming to us from the Associated Press, the headline is, Two Men Who Filmed Namibia Seal Hunt Convicted. Two foreign journalists who were arrested in Namibia while filming the clubbing of seals were convicted Friday of entering a protected marine area without a permit. British journalist Jim Wickens and his South African cameraman Bart Smithers appeared in a magistrate's court in the coastal town of Swakopmund. They were given the choice of 12 months in jail or a fine of 10,000 Namibian dollars, each about $1,200 American, along with a 6-month suspended sentence, said Namibian police spokesman Angula Amulungu. Their employer, the British investigative agency Ecostorm, has agreed to pay the fine, said spokesman Andrew Wasley. In a matter the court did not consider, Wasley said the two men alleged that the Sealers attacked them. The men were in Namibia to produce a documentary on the controversial seal hunt, which animal activists say is barbaric and outdated. Wasley said that Wickens and Smithers were filming near Namibia's Cape Cross colony on the isolated northern coast of the country on Thursday morning when Sealers assaulted them. Quote, they were chased and attacked with clubs used to kill seals, Wasley said of the journalists. Police arrived and arrested the journalists, who were detained for several hours in the town of Henties Bay, before being released on bail. The attackers remain at large. Namibia's seals number about 850,000 and live on a dozen remote rocky islands off the coast of the sparsely populated southern African country. More than 90,000 seals will be clubbed to death during the annual sealing season, which started in July. The hunt takes place under clandestine circumstances to avoid the glare of publicity and to avoid upsetting tourists. The government has said seals consume 900,000 tons of fish each year, more than a third of the fishing industry's catch, and that the cull is needed to protect fisheries. Animal welfare groups counter that most of the seals killed are nursing pups. Wasley said journalists' experience would draw more attention to the Namibian seal hunt, usually overshadowed by its more publicized Canadian counterpart. A lot of people aren't aware of its existence, he said. This will put a spotlight on Namibia. And you can definitely see echoes of the Canadian seal hunt in pretty much every detail in that story. The final story today coming to us from the Surrey Comet, which is a newspaper based out of the UK. So just to be clear here, the Kingston that they're talking about is Kingston in Surrey, United Kingdom. The headline is, Animal Campaigners Call on Kingston Council to Ban Goldfish Fair Prizes. Animal lovers are demanding Kingston Council bans goldfish being given as prizes at fairs. Christine Orton, 51, was left upset after seeing the pets being given away at Hook Fair last Saturday, July 18th, believing the tradition was now illegal. Under the Animal Welfare Act of 2005, it is illegal to give a prize fish to an unaccompanied child under 16, but some councils have banned it altogether on their land after pressure from animal rights activists. Mrs. Orton said she was disgusted Kingston Council had not followed suit and mocked up a picture of Kingston's three fish logo with three dead fish in protest. She said, quote, considering three fish have been Kingston's logo for hundreds of years, it's absolutely horrendous that Kingston Council can't do something for other fish. Fish are living beings. A lot of people forget that they have feelings like a furry cat or a hairy dog. The fairs keep them in unacceptable condition. They ferry them around with only a little bit of air. The stallholders can't see where the fish is going or what is happening to it. They need to make you aware that you're going to have the duty of care and that you have the right home for it and tell you what to do if it gets sick. Mrs. Orton and partner Kieran Kirk of York Way, Chestington, confronted organizers Surbiton Rotary Club at the fair on King Edward Recreation Ground and called the RSPCA for guidance on the law. She added, quote, it did cast a bit of a black cloud over the day because you couldn't help thinking how many of these fish were going to make it to the next day. Rotary Club President Malcolm Finn said the law was not broken at Saturday's fair, but the moral issues over whether to allow live animals again will be decided before next year's fair. He said he was not aware the stallholder had goldfish as prizes until he arrived on the day. A Kingston Council spokesman said, quote, while the council can stipulate how its own land and property may be used by hirers, as a licensing authority, the council cannot attach a condition prohibiting the giving of animals as prizes on any premises that it licenses. And that, my friends, is the news for today. An interesting little roundup of stories that I personally have never seen before. And that's saying something because I look at hundreds of stories each week, and many of them are strange and fantastic. Not necessarily fantastic in a good way. So on today's Animal Voices program, we are going to be speaking with Leslie Irvine. Leslie is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Colorado at Boulder. She received her PhD from the State University of New York at Stony Brook, and her research focuses on the role of animals in society. She studied animal sheltering, human-animal relationships, and most recently, animals in disaster. Her latest book, which we'll be talking about today, is entitled Filling the Ark, Animal Welfare in Disasters. And throughout this book, she urges us strongly to rethink not only our uses of animals, but especially how our uses of animals make them more vulnerable in times of disaster and crisis. She is also the author of other books such as If You Tame Me, Understanding Our Connection with Animals, and numerous articles on our relationships with other species. Leslie, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carl.
Thank you for being here. I wanted to ask you a little bit first, how you got interested in looking at animals and disasters. You've obviously looked at animal issues before, but what turned you to this topic?
I turned to look at disasters because I became aware of disasters in general through a research center at the University of Colorado that's dedicated to the study of disasters. And they really were not on my radar screen as a topic of study before that. And suddenly I was around people who were studying disasters. And then when the World Trade Center disaster happened, I began to see images, very few, but some images of people carrying cats and dogs out of their apartments in the lower part of Manhattan. And a light went on that, you know, the animals are affected too. There are animals left behind. There are animals who have to be evacuated. And then there were dogs who were involved in the search and recovery process. So I began to investigate what we as a society were doing for animals in disasters. And I found out about some of the response teams that had been developed. I went to talk to people who had been involved in the Hurricane Andrew response, which was the first MASH unit for companion animals back in 1992. And then as my research progressed, I was able to go to several hurricane sites and examine the responses firsthand. And that kind of culminated with my work in New Orleans following Katrina.
I'm so interested in asking you about the title. You talk about the title a little bit in the book, and when I first saw the book, it struck me, you know, I had a Catholic upbringing, and the, you know, this image of the ark and filling the ark with the animals that are deemed worthy is such a strong one. And you really center your book around two sort of key questions, which are, do animals have a place on the ark, and which of those animals can come aboard?
That's right. I'm glad that message comes through. Well, I was raised Catholic, too, and so that image is powerful for me. And, you know, we have this idea, at least from the myth, that Noah somehow brought two of every animal onto the ark. And that's nice to think that it's possible, but we know it's not possible. So we spend great amounts of time and effort recovering the animals we consider pets. But the ones that we consider food, like the chickens who lay eggs and who are raised for meat, they're a commodity and they're worthless after a disaster, so we just bulldoze them into pits. And I point out in the book that people don't realize that 8,000 animals died in research labs following Hurricane Katrina. And the reason no one pays attention to this or that it got little publicity is because they were research mice. So if 8,000 dogs and cats had died, there would be an outrage. But because they're mice and rats, we've decided that there isn't really any room for them on the ark. We can just, you know, reproduce them when we eat them.
So maybe then at this point then, you could tell us a little bit about what you talk about at the beginning of the book, which is the socio-zoological scale.
Right. The socio-zoological scale places animals on a hierarchy according to human standards. So at the bottom of the scale are the animals who are what we consider least like us, least useful, least pleasant. And so we could think of maybe cockroaches and fleas are at the bottom.
Right.
And then we work our way up and we decide which animals are going to be placed where on the hierarchy. And it doesn't have anything to do with their biological qualities. It simply has to do with where we've decided their moral status is. So dogs and cats are at the top. Horses are at the top. Farm animals are probably second tier because we recognize that they're nice to look at. We need them around, but we don't want to come to terms with the fact that they're sentient beings too, just like our dogs and cats. So the scale works like that. The animals that we like the most, need the most, we put higher up on the scale.
Can you tell me a bit about choice of dividing the book in this way. You've separated the book into sections on companion animals, animals on factory farms, birds in marine wildlife, and animals in research facilities. Why separate the book in that way? Was it a choice to sort of highlight this sociozoological scale, or was there something else at play there as well?
Well, there are a number of ways that the book could have been organized, but the kinds of disasters that take place and the setting in which they occur determines the response that's going to ensue. So I began to think about how to organize the book, and clearly companion animals receive very different treatment. So it made sense for me to talk about them separately from animals raised for food, for example, and animals in research labs, because the response is just so different. So then I began to look for case studies of each kind of animal that I could develop into a chapter to talk about how these different kinds of animals receive different treatment in disaster response.
I think probably for most people, the most recent and sort of the disaster that probably sticks out in people's mind the most when it comes to animal rescue is probably Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah.
Although you do start the companion animal section with a couple of other with a discussion of a couple of other hurricanes, the primary focus of that section is on Hurricane Katrina. So maybe we could talk about that. It seems that, for all intents and purposes, Hurricane Katrina was a complete disaster. Not to repeat the word too much, but it was a complete disaster for the animals involved. Can you give us a sense of what, I mean, a lot of people did see images on TV here and there, but I think, you know, and I had done research into it myself because I had done some written work about how animals were treated in Hurricane Katrina, but I was still shocked to hear some of the things that that happened to them. Could you describe a bit what that situation looked like?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Hurricane Katrina essentially challenged everything we thought we knew about animals in disasters. There's been some research that has looked at the willingness of people to evacuate, and sometimes people are not willing to leave a disaster because they can't take their animals with them, but plenty of people do leave their animals behind. And the existing research said, well, the willingness to leave an animal behind depends on a lot of things that have to do with the human-animal bond. You know, how close are you to the animal? How often do you take the animal to the vet? Does the animal live in your house, or is it kept outside? Hurricane Katrina changed all that because it was an instance in which people who cared deeply about their animals were sometimes forced by the National Guard, by local police officers, to leave those animals behind. And even people who went to great lengths to evacuate animals to a safe place for additional transport were forced at that point to leave their animals behind. And then there was the horrible instance in St. Bernard Parish where law enforcement evacuated people who had left their animals behind with food, with information, you know, with the understanding that these deputies would take their animals to shelter. And they just went in and shot all the animals. And, you know, there's plenty of evidence. This went to court. The case was eventually dismissed. But, you know, there's just a gruesome, gruesome story there. And even the animals who were evacuated, you know, those who were not reunited with their families were sent all over the country to different foster homes. When I worked in the sheltering area in Gonzales, Louisiana, the animals were just, you know, so stressed. Most of them were, they all had to be kept kenneled, but most of them were just, you know, rammed up right next to another dog. There wasn't adequate places to walk them. It was just a really bad situation for animals and the people who cared for them.
It was quite eye-opening to read a statistic that you have in that chapter talking about the sheer number of households that had some kind of animal either in the house or outside of the house, somewhere between 70 and 75% of households. And it got me sort of thinking, you know, these issues sort of in a disaster setting, evacuation, some people are abandoning their animals, but some people are separated. There was obviously a lot of people who either chose to or were separated from their animals for various reasons. I guess one of the questions that came to mind while I was reading that was, why would the animals not be allowed to be evacuated with the people? There were many people who couldn't leave the cities for various reasons. They didn't have transportation. Why would the animals not have been allowed to go with them?
That's a really good question. Animals prior to Katrina, they were not allowed on any form of public transportation. So any of the buses that were enlisted to evacuate people couldn't accommodate animals. Red Cross shelters cannot accommodate people and animals in the same facility. They have been working to develop what are called pet-friendly shelters, where the animals are accommodated on the same site, like close by. If a school is converted to an evacuation site, maybe the cafeteria would house people and the gymnasium would house animals. But there was nothing like that before Katrina. And the National Guard had instructions to take only people when they did their evacuation. So animals just were not even on the list of who could leave. And you're absolutely right. You know, if you figure the average is 70% of households include dogs and cats, and if you add in birds and in some areas horses, the figure goes higher. And most people who have animals have more than one animal. So when you talk about evacuating, you know, you're adding in a lot of household members once you include animals.
This whole mess of a situation in Katrina led to the Pets Act, signed into law by George W. Bush. Maybe you could give us a little bit of an overview about what the Pets Act was, and I don't want to ask you to editorialize, but maybe you could give us a sense of if you think that it's actually resulted in some sort of meaningful change.
Well, I have mixed feelings about the Pets Act. I'm first of all very, very happy that it's in place, because it does, first of all, modify sections of existing disaster legislation to include companion animals and service animals in disaster response plans. So communities are supposed to incorporate provisions for animals in their emergency planning. And there is supposed to be the risk of losing federal funding if animals are not incorporated. So what that means is that animals will now be allowed on public transportation. But that means, you know, the animal has to be in a carrier. That doesn't help for the woman or the couple who have six cats. That doesn't help the person who has potbelly pigs. That doesn't help, you know, the person who's got 12 birds, or the person who, we ran across this quite a lot in Louisiana, the person who is a hoarder or a collector. And, you know, has been going along accumulating cats or dogs or some other species, and all of a sudden a disaster strikes, and it's a disaster on top of a disaster. Mm-hmm. So the Pets Act doesn't provide for every contingency, but it certainly is a step in the right direction, and it's a step toward recognizing the importance of animals in human lives.
Maybe that's a good point to take a pause. There are lots of animals, other animals, that are important in our lives for another reason. They make up the majority. So maybe we're going to take a short break, play a station ID, and maybe when we come back we can talk about animals on factory farms.
Great.
Today we are speaking with Leslie Irvine. She's the author of Filling the Ark, Animal Welfare in Disasters. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. My name is Carl Zachowski. I'm your host for today. And today we are speaking with Leslie Irvine, the author of the fantastic book, Filling the Ark, Animal Welfare in Disasters. Leslie is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And before the break, we were talking quite a bit about what happened to animals, companion animals specifically, in Hurricane Katrina. And now I'd like to turn a little bit to talk about the same disaster and other similar disasters, and to talk about what happened to animals on factory farms. Leslie, there you cite a USDA stat in the beginning of the chapter that says that animals on factory farms make up, obviously, the majority of the animal population in the United States, and that each year 10 billion animals are raised for food per year in the U.S. alone. Obviously, these conditions make them much more vulnerable than other animals, so maybe you could give us a little bit of a sense for the viewers who may not be aware. What does a factory farm look like? You talk a lot about chickens, so maybe let's talk about chicken farms.
Yeah, I talk about chickens because it struck me that while rescuers were risking their lives to rescue some birds from the city of New Orleans, other birds in the Gulf region were just being bulldozed and gassed because they were rendered worthless. So factory farm is the brainchild of industrial agriculture. And in post-World War II agriculture, the idea has just been to produce more meat, more eggs, more milk, faster. And in order to find ways to do that, it's involved crowding animals together, treating them as commodities, and raising them in areas that are simply dedicated to animal agriculture. So, if, for example, if you can picture the old McDonald's farm, you have the old McDonald who raised the hay and the other grains, and the animals would be out grazing, and there would be lots of things going on the farm. Well, those farms, as many of your listeners will know, those farms don't exist anymore. No one can make a living on those farms anymore. A few people can. So the farms are owned by corporations, and thousands, tens of thousands, in some cases millions of animals are raised on one site. And they're all crowded together, and there's nothing else that happens on that site. So there are many, many problems that ensue, having to do especially with dealing with manure. So all the manure is collected in one place instead of, you know, in the old McDonald's scenario, instead of being able to be dispersed over a smaller area and used as fertilizer. What do you do with the manure from thousands and thousands of pigs or millions of chickens? So there are lots of environmental problems that occur with factory farms. And we also concentrate these farms in parts of countries that where labor is cheap, because we're not raising these animals using high standards of animal husbandry. We're not building relationships with them. We need people who can just do the work quickly and, you know, just follow the rules, feed the animals, get them in. Lots of the work is also automated. So feeding and watering and regulation of light is automated. Now, when a disaster strikes, one of the first things that happens is the power goes out. So automated feeding, automated watering, ventilation is knocked out. Roofs were blown off of the chicken sheds. Chickens, I should say, are raised in, at least meat chickens are raised in these long sheds called broiler sheds, and they're crammed together in horrific conditions. And following Katrina, the tornado that came in Katrina's wake pulled the roof off of many, many growing sheds in Georgia. And thousands of birds were killed. Many of the others were trapped in the twisted wire of the sheds that remained. So without electricity, deprived of food and water, exposed to the elements, the birds would die of thirst and starvation. So that's the reality for animals raised for food, for at least chickens, in a disaster. And in the 1990s, Hurricane Floyd struck the coastal region of North Carolina, and that part of the country is a huge pork-producing area. And, you know, there are many, many images and stories of what happened to the hog farms, the lagoons that contain the manure released poisons into the bays and estuaries around there, and a decade later, they're still dealing with the consequences, not to mention that thousands and thousands of pigs drowned or had to be preemptively slaughtered because they were useless from the trauma, useless for meat, at least.
It's interesting that you mention the word preemptively slaughtered.
Yes.
Because it sort of highlights one of the central themes of this chapter, and I guess more generally in the book, which is sort of there are different, in response to these disasters, there seem to be different discourses, and one of the discourses, at least with companion animals, is a rescue discourse, and then the other discourse is one of disposal. These are economic units, essentially, and they've been damaged, or there's, you know, the disaster has created this mess, so we're going to just dispose of them and restock and start over. Can you describe a little bit more what that disposal looked like and what it involved?
Yeah. In terms of the chickens, the person who is responsible for growing, for actually raising the chickens in a factory farm does not technically own them. They're owned by a company like Tyson or Purdue. And so the person who we think of as the farmer doesn't actually have the right to say what happened to the chickens. So after Katrina, millions and millions of birds were trapped in broiler production facilities in the Gulf region, so Louisiana, Florida, Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia. And the Humane Society of the United States actually put the number of animals being raised in that area at the time in the billions. So there were, you know, millions and millions and millions of chickens trapped, and rescuers described the scene as so many birds that it looked like a field of cotton. And so people from Farm Sanctuary, Animal Place, Humane Society of the United States set out to try and see what they could do to rescue some of the birds. So arriving at a site, the person that you come in contact with says, well, these birds don't belong to me. You can't rescue them. This is my property, but the operation is owned by a corporation, so that rescuer doesn't have anything to say, or that farmer, rather, doesn't have anything to say. In the case of many disasters, the person who is considered the farmer actually at some point says, well, sure, you go ahead and, you know, try to rescue as many animals, as many birds as you can, because otherwise they're just going to starve to death. So they're just exposed to the elements. There's no responsibility to feed them, as they just become a liability for the growers at that point. So they're disposed of as economically as possible. And for chickens, that involves scooping them up with a bulldozer and putting them in large dumpsters, and then covering them over with a tarp, and then CO2 gas is injected. And so many of the birds are already suffering greatly from heat, from starvation, from thirst. And when they're put into this dumpster, many of them suffocate because of the weight of their own brothers, sisters, and cousins. So the gas is pumped in, and they are the birds are killed that way, and then they're ground up, and the disposal happens in a number of ways. Mainly chicken carcasses are used, I believe, for fertilizer. So, you know, if you can imagine doing this with thousands and thousands of dogs and cats, you can see...
I certainly can't actually imagine us doing that with thousands and thousands of dogs and cats.
You can see the sociozoologic scale at work there. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there are horrific images available of chickens being bulldozed and gas.
I was really surprised, speaking again of the sociozoological scale, I was really surprised then by the next chapter of the book that deals with birds and marine wildlife. And I guess I was surprised by it, because I think I've operated under the assumption for a long time that wild animals are generally speaking more valued than domesticated animals or food animals or farm animals, that sort of thing. So I was surprised to learn that that's not necessarily the case, and maybe part of that has to do with the fact that these animals are not owned by anyone. They're just sort of out there. And in that chapter you talk about human-made disasters, specifically oil spills. So maybe let's talk about, I feel like we're kind of doing a bit of a litany of horror here, but maybe we could talk a little bit about birds and marine wildlife and oil spills.
The research for me really raised the question of who is responsible for wildlife. If it were, let's say, some kind of disease that was inherent to wildlife species that we were not responsible for, would there be call for us to jump in and try to save the animals? I don't know that that's really the case. But if we dump a bunch of petroleum into, a nesting area or a place like Prince William Sound, then there is some responsibility to try and restore things to the way they had been. And there are many, many, many species that rely on coastal regions, that live in marine environments, and oil is a serious toxin. So when we're responsible for contaminating the water that they live in, the question is, what do we do then? And there is, as I point out in the book, there's some research that shows that rehabilitation is very stressful for the animals, and it's not always successful. Mm-hmm. So
something like a 90% failure rate in some cases.
They've tagged birds that have been rehabilitated, and very few of them were found alive within a year or within the time period of the study after being rehabilitated. And no one really knows if that's from the effects of the rehabilitation or from the effects of petroleum, which, if an animal or bird has been exposed for a long time, it can have neurological and reproductive and endocrine consequences. And rehabilitating is also really expensive. And I talk in the book about the otters. And otters became kind of the poster child for the Exxon Valdez oil spill. No one wants to see an oil-covered otter.
Mm.
But it costs a tremendous amount of money to rehabilitate one otter. And then there's the question of, is that going to be successful? Is that animal going to then go off and be able to reproduce? But there's public outcry if we just said, okay, we're going to gather all these animals up and just, treat them like we do chickens. We'll just dispose of them in some economically efficient way,
right.
There would be public outrage. No one can imagine, sea otters being treated that way. So we try to rehabilitate them.
So who pays for this? Who is responsible in the end?
The oil companies are technically responsible. Now, a lot of the work is done by volunteers. I talk about the International Bird Research and Rescue Center in the book, and they do incredible work. Some of their funding comes from the oil companies. Some of it also comes from, private donors and people who send in small contributions. But when a disaster actually happens, there are well-meaning volunteers who show up by the drove, who really want to help, who feel helpless and to some extent responsible, and they want to be involved. So the oil companies do pay. I'm sure they never pay enough, and they actually do just about everything they can to get out of doing things to make sure that spills don't happen again.
The sort of the next startling turn. I read this book, I feel like, at the edge of my seat, and the sort of each chapter that I came upon had some new kind of revelation, despite the fact that I've been reading about animal issues for a while, and in your chapter about animals in research facilities, and especially talking about the plight of the research mouse, I was surprised to learn that mice are not even... whereas, you know, companion animals might have a very special place, and factory farmed animals might be thought of at the very least as property, birds and marine wildlife valued in their own particular way, mice are not even defined as animals under the Federal Animal Welfare Act. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about how this has happened, and what kind of vulnerability research animals face in disasters.
Yeah, that was a real learning experience for me too, and again, it just illuminated our power over other species to determine their moral status and their position on this socio-zoologic scale. The legislation known as the Animal Welfare Act, it was initially put into place in the United States to protect dogs and cats from theft by research labs. And so it was discovered that pets were being literally stolen out of people's backyards and ended up in research labs. The legislation was passed to require research labs to get their animals from particular sources. So you couldn't just steal somebody's beagle and do tests on it, but you could then breed a beagle, or breed many, many, many thousands of beagles, and mm-hmm. use them in research. But dogs and cats are protected. They're considered animals, and so their treatment is protected by some pieces of legislation. So they would be rescued if there were a disaster in a research lab. But the act is written in such a way that it excludes rats and mice that were specifically bred for research purposes. So if someone has a rat or a mouse as a pet and the disaster occurred, you could rescue that mouse, but there's no obligation to rescue the rats and mice that are locked up in research labs after a disaster because they were specifically bred for research purposes.
Right, and I guess I'm now thinking, in addition to the sort of the rescue discourse and the disposal discourse, in the chapter on animals in research facilities, as little media coverage as these sort of research animals in floods or in hurricanes received was generally centered around the loss of data.
That's right. They'll never say, "Oh, we're so sorry, we lost all these animals." It was, "Well, I've got to start over in my research. I've lost data. We've lost these cell lines," which are what mice are bred for. They're, you know, they carry a specific strain of cells that the research is done on.
Mm-hmm. You conclude the book by talking a little bit about, well, actually, fairly in detail about some suggestions that you have to sort of ameliorate the situation of different kinds of animals in disasters. And you start that chapter by talking about sort of the chorus that you hear repeated over and over again, which is, we never imagined that this kind of thing would happen. You know, we could not have foreseen it. And so you center your discussion a little bit about expecting the worst. But you're also not, you also make it clear that you're not necessarily saying that any of these practices are justified. But that being said, there are plenty of things we can do, or plenty of things industry and these various other sort of areas can do to make animals less vulnerable. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. I would love to see a world in which animals have the right not to be treated as property, a world in which we don't enslave other animals for food and we don't think of them as commodities that we can do research on because we've decided not to consider their lives worthwhile. But I also know that I can't stop those practices overnight. You know, people are going to go on eating meat. People are going to go on doing research in labs. So let's find ways to make animals less vulnerable. as I said, I would love for people to stop producing animals for food, but as long as we're going to, let's do it in ways that allows animals to be placed in less of harm's way than they are right now. So let's not have these hog production facilities in floodplains. Let's not raise animals in tornado or hurricane-prone areas. And let's rethink factory farming altogether. And I think the tide is turning somewhat, thanks to, you know, people like Michael Pollan and others who have brought the horrors of factory farming to light. There are more people who are considering more humanely raised animals. So let's give animals a chance to survive. In terms of research labs, let's actually follow the steps that the researchers agree need to be adhered to. Let's reduce the number of animals that are used, refine the procedures that are used on them, and find replacements for animal models where that's possible to do. And instead, what's happened is they're actually using more animals in research than a decade ago. So that those, let's follow the legislation or the recommendations that are actually in place. In terms of companion animals, you know, if you are in a position where you cannot evacuate yourself safely from an emergency, maybe it's not a good idea. Maybe you're not really entitled to have a dog or a cat. And if you do have a dog and a cat or a bird or a pot-bellied pig or whatever as a companion, you have a responsibility to think about what kind of hazards you face in your area and how you're going to respond if your home is threatened. Do you have a place to go? Do you know what to do? What's going to happen if you're not home to your dog or your cat or your bird? And in terms of oil spills, there is legislation on the books to transition to double-hulled tankers. The oil companies are doing mm-hmm. everything they can to drag their heels and slow that process. I think that is the biggest step to preventing oil spills. I would like to say, let's go to alternative energy so that we don't, you know, we aren't transporting oil in tin cans around the ocean, mm-hmm. but that transition isn't going to happen overnight. So while we're working on alternative energy, let's remember, you know, double-hulled tankers, move ahead with humane rehabilitation technologies. So my point in the book is to make animals less vulnerable. That we can't eliminate hazards altogether. Disasters are always going to be possible. So let's make them and ourselves less vulnerable so that we're not left in the aftermath saying, oh, we never imagined it could be this bad.
Leslie, we've only got about a minute left in the program, and I wanted to make sure to turn it over to you. If you had a website you wanted to plug, or if you wanted to talk about some research that you've got upcoming. I heard a dog in the background. Maybe you wanted to give a shout-out to your dog on the air.
I've got four cats here and a dog who was barking at the FedEx delivery truck. I do want to give a shout-out to my husband, Mark Krulowicz, who's been very patient through the research and manned the fort while I was off rescuing animals after Katrina.
Okay. Thank you so much for being on the program, Leslie. I can't say enough good things about this book. The book is called Filling the Ark, Animal Welfare in Disasters. It's out on Temple University Press. It has been an absolute pleasure having you on the program.
The pleasure was mine. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. Again, I can't say enough good things about this book. Filling the Ark, Animal Welfare in Disasters is an incredibly well-placed and well-thought-out book. Please do check it out. If you can't find it at your local bookstore, go to the big guys, because you will not regret picking this one up. Coming up next on CIUT is Dos Mundos. Boom. Please stay tuned.